Delighted that you're here. We have visitors with us. We're glad that you've come and hope you can come back and be with us again at other occasions. Starting next Lord's Day evening, Skylar Hornaday will be working with the church in our summer program, as others have worked with us in the past, and he'll begin his work next Lord's Day evening, be preaching next Sunday evening, and will begin his work through the summer, and so we look forward to that summer program. I have been asked if I could deal with the house church movement. You may or may not be familiar with the house church movement. This is the kind of material I'd much rather be taking a textual study, as we did this morning, and working our way through the text. And yet we need to deal with these kinds of principles from time to time and talk about some of the dangers that are among us. And so I've been asked if I could address the question of the house church movement. The house church movement is a movement that for several years has been called the house church movement. Perhaps it ought to be called something else in the present day because of the ever-evolving and progressive nature of the movement that we'll see a little bit later. This is not peculiar among churches of Christ. This started out among the denominational groups. In fact, much of the writing that has been done about the house church movement started with denominational writers talking about their dissatisfaction with traditional religion. And they were moving out from the organized religion into some house church arrangement. It has worked among brethren for several years, for a number of years, 10 to 15 years among our brethren. It has been working, and it's still alive and working very much alive among some of our brethren even today, and we'll see more about that here in just a minute. I'll give you some examples of some of the house churches among us. There's one of those, one of the oldest of these, began several years ago over here in Franklin, Tennessee. They now call themselves, I'm not sure this was the name they gave at the beginning, but they call themselves the Williamson County Church. I know of people in that church and have some connection with some people that are involved in that church, but that's one of the first that started a number of years ago. Closely related to it, I think started even before that perhaps, was the church in Bowling Green. They call themselves the Church at Bowling Green. And I think their website is CABG, and if you put that together, they call themselves the Cabbage Church, using that as an acronym, and they refer to themselves as the Cabbage Church. And at CABG.com, I believe, is their website. And I know of people and know of some folks that I've worshipped with in the past that are part of that group there in the Bowling Green area. There is one, I understand, I know very little about, in the Florence, Kentucky area, one in Athens, Alabama. There is a group in Tampa, Florida. They call themselves Christians in Tampa. And more recently, the one that has caused a great bit of stir among those who studied on the house church movement is the church in Birmingham. They call themselves the Church at Birmingham. We'll talk about how far some of these groups have gone here in just a moment. We're hearing of reports of churches of the house church movement affecting places like Kansas City and Huntsville and Denver and St. Louis, and that's just a sampling of those among us. The institutional brethren have faced this problem, even as we have, for some time. Now, what's true of one of these groups is not necessarily true of the other group. Some of the things we'll talk about tonight, you may say, well, I know of a particular group, and they don't practice that, and that's probably true. But one of the other groups do. And so what's true of one is not necessarily true of the other. What one will practice or believe, another one may not. Some are more progressive than others. Some a little more traditional than others, even though all of them set out to be anti-traditional, and we'll talk about that driving force here in just a moment. Now, this is not going to be an exhaustive study, obviously, in one lesson. Some brethren who have done their homework on this are doing series of studies on this because of the danger. They're living in areas where they've had their members go to these house churches and they've had to exercise church discipline over that. And so they're having to do a great deal of work and study on that. This is merely an overview. So I call this simply the house church movement and beyond. We're at the stage of being beyond in our present day. Three major points I want to talk about tonight. Let's start with the identity of the movement. What is this movement and what is it about? When we call it the house church movement, we're not merely dealing with the question of meeting in someone's house. And when a church meets in a dwelling place that someone owns, that's not the question at all. Churches did meet in houses at times. We're not going to take the time to read these. If you want to make a reference for your own study, we'll come back to these a little bit later. But Romans 16:5, 1 Corinthians 16 and 19, Colossians 4:15, Philemon 2, are references where churches would meet in houses. That was not exclusive. Churches met in other places as well, such as the temple area. We'll give an example of that here in just a moment. But really the movement, and we're trying to identify the movement and not talk about the church house itself or where they're meeting, though that becomes a part of the play or the question. It's more about what they believe in practice and the drive and the motive that they have than where they meet. No one questions about meeting in a house. Many churches started in that. Often when churches start, they're small in number. There may be 10 or 12 people, and they'll meet in someone's house until they grow larger, until they can purchase a bigger place. And that's happening to these house churches, by the way, quite ironically, that we'll get to in a second. Let's talk about what they're driven by. It is driven by dissatisfaction. The common denominator among those who seem to be a part of the house church movement, they're driven by dissatisfaction, and that is a feeling that churches have lost their spirituality and they're stuck in a rut of traditionalism. And so you find that among denominational groups, somebody says, you know, we're just stuck in the rut of tradition. We just do the same thing over and over. You hear people talk about things like we're in this routine of two songs and a prayer. And we have a sermon, and then we dismiss. And we have an invitation song, and it's over. And so we're stuck in the rut of traditionalism, they say. And so those who are dissatisfied with that are those that are excited about the house church movement. That's one of the driving force. The driving force behind it is liberal thinking. And the evidence of that is it's found among denominational groups, those who have a liberal concept anyway. And then it's also affected among those who are the institutional churches of Christ. Men like Wayne Jackson, if you're familiar with the Christian Courier, has done some writing and dealing with that among them. And he talks about the house church movement a little bit. But it's found among non-institutional churches, and that's the ones that I'm concerned about in our study tonight. There were two works that originally were behind the impact of the beginning of this movement among us. And it's important because these were the works that were kind of the driving force of getting the house church movement rolling among us. But these are not necessarily the driving force now. And what I mean by that is some, for example, in the church at Bowling Green or the Franklin Church or the church at Birmingham, were probably not even familiar with these works I'm about to mention. Here is one of the first. Ethelgard Smith's work called Radical Restoration. He spent his time among institutional churches of Christ, but he came from a family that were among the non-institutional brethren. His mother, I think, was a dorm mother down at Florida College for a number of years, years and years ago, back in the 60s or 70s or something like that. His dad was, I think, named Frank Smith, and many of you read some of his writings years ago. But Ethelgard Smith wrote this book called Radical Restoration, and he's calling for pure and simple Christianity. And to bear with some of the quotations, because here is where this concept began. In some of his writings as it began to advance. He talks about how the first century church had the Lord's Supper along with a common meal, and we should do the very same thing. He talks about house churches being a pattern of the first century, and we should do the same thing. So he talks about this concept. There should be no structure, no organization. The goal of the house church is a setting where things would be intimate, informal, spontaneous, personal, active, and mutual participatory. And that is, here's this mutual edification that we'll get to even a little bit later. Now here's some of the things he says about the house church. He says maybe that's where we all went wrong in the first place. Maybe the church should never have left the home. That we should go back to the houses. He cites a number of places that we've already cited where churches met in houses. No one disputes that. He said there seems to be little question, but the first century Christians met together in small groups in house churches. Now he's wrong about that. They did meet in small groups, and they did meet in house churches, but there were large groups that met. I can give evidence of thousands meeting, for example, in Acts chapter 2. The house church, he says, was a natural setting for edification and exhortation. Notice he's leaning to the idea that a smaller group setting is far better for mutual edification, and it's far better for edification than for a large group. And so you can't really be edified sitting here tonight, but you could be edified if five or six of you went into a home somewhere. That's his idea and that's his concept. Well, he goes further to say, historically, of course, we know that it was not until the 3rd century that Christians began to erect what we would recognize as church buildings. Well, he's absolutely wrong about that as well. But nonetheless, he said, piecing together archaeology and history, it appears the primitive church typically met in a room sufficiently large enough for probably 40 or 50 people in the house of wealthy people. So he's arguing for this fact that smaller settings, smaller groups, house churches. In the house church, the role of the official clergy virtually vanished in the midst of simple fellowship meal. And what he's calling a fellowship meal is where you get together and you have a common meal and have the Lord's Supper in conjunction with that. And as did the structured ritual and liturgy and the sacrosanct tradition. In other words, you got away from tradition and what we have now, if you get back to what we had in the New Testament and restore New Testament Christianity, you have these house churches. I understand some of these quotations are a little lengthy, but I'm trying to thread some things together for those who have asked for some of this material. And hopefully have it on the tape, and it'll be on the internet as well for those who are searching for more. This is from page 178 of Smith's book called Radical Restoration. Here's his concept about elders. We'll come back to this and talk about the elders in just a second. He said there is nothing to rule out the possibility. Notice what he says about elders. The possibility of the role of elders in the early church might well have encompassed more than one level of involvement, a hierarchy and various levels of elderships. Even some... Simultaneously, perhaps there were elders shepherding the disciples in each house, depending on the size and the makeup, and perhaps elder oversight may have been exercised through a group of house churches, which collectively compromised a larger, recognizable congregation. Without reading the rest of the quotation, what he says is there's about three possibilities. One is that they may have had elders in some of these churches, but it's more likely, he thinks, that there were elders maybe that were involved over several of these house churches, or maybe there was a multi-level eldership. A hierarchy kind of eldership. And you might have had an eldership wherein there was elders over several of these churches scattered throughout Jerusalem, he said. Well, he blames this on youth ministers. He came out of a group where there were youth ministers. And he says that that was what brought in the division of the generations for replacing the function of the home and causing an improper shift in the leadership. Here is his quotation. I won't read all this. He said, why are the young people so excited when they return home from a weekend retreat? Camp meetings, in other words. I suggest it's because they've experienced something similar to radical restoration. Well, I continue to be concerned at what I believe to be a lack of biblical depth and study in song. He said that parents ought to be involved in that. And I want to drop down into the quotation about this point. He said, here's what they were really excited about. When the kids come back from those retreats, it's the spontaneity, informality, intimacy, and mutual participation of a type of young people rarely witnessed in their structured assemblies. And of course, there's all that table fellowship which breaks down so many barriers. So what we need to get in our services and our worship in the church needs to be more like a camp meeting, is what he said. Well, brethren were reading that, and they were enamored by that, and that's kind of what spawned some of the concepts among us about 10 or 15 years ago, of the house church movement. There was another work that was also responsible called Come to the Table. This is by John Mark Hicks. He was a professor at the time at David Lipscomb University. I won't give but this one quotation or two from him, and that is, he said, the church should revision the supper as a meal rather than simply bread and wine. It's a meal. Come to the table. He talks about table fellowship is the focal point. So the big thrust behind the house church movement is what they call table fellowship. And so it's the fellowship that you have around the dinner table, and we'll say more about how that's conducted in a moment. Now, what are their goals? Well, there's different goals depending on who you talk to. There are some in this movement that they have this goal to restore New Testament Christianity. They want to get back to the way it was in the first century. Ethelgard Smith had that kind of goal. He attempted to turn back the clock to restore the worship. Ackerson said that the apostles intended for the churches to follow the same apostolic patterns even today. So some are saying, we want to get back to the way it was in the first century, where they met in houses and sat around a table and had table fellowship. There are others that are more liberal who are saying that what we want to recapture is not this concept of restoring New Testament Christianity, but the spirit of Christianity and our own culture. Such as Robert Banks, he said, it is not the recreation of the first century church that is the goal, it's the desire to recapture the spirit and dynamics of the early church in ways that are appropriate to our own culture. Well, what that does is open the door for anything. And you see where that's going. And that's where it's gone. That's why I call this the house church movement and beyond. Now let's give an overview of what the movement is about. Well, there's great focus on the Lord's Supper. They've turned it into a meal. Now there's division among some of these as to what it should be. Some make a meal out of the Lord's Supper. Some of them even using leavened bread, where you get together in this setting and we have a meal of the Lord's Supper. So we have large amounts of bread, and we have large amounts of the grape juice or the wine, and you make a meal out of that. And so it is the Lord's Supper. It's a meal, they argue. Some have said, no, you don't make a meal out of the Lord's Supper, but you incorporate it in conjunction with a common meal and a potluck meal. Now, as strange as it may sound, that would mean you have a common meal sitting around where you have your beans and potatoes and corn and chicken, etc., all of that on the table, and then in the middle of that you have your bread and your wine or the fruit of the vine, depending on which one they want to use. And you eat all of that together, and it's just a common meal like we would have at a potluck, where you're talking and visiting with one another. But you might be visiting about what Jesus means to me. By the way, hand me another one of them rolls. What does Jesus mean to you? Pass the chicken, by the way. I think I need some more unleavened bread. or leavened bread, as the case may be. Well, that's going on among these folks. Now, emphasis is given to eating larger pieces of the bread and drinking larger portion of the grape juice. They ridicule us and call us the pinch and sip brethren. You just get a little pinch and you sip a little bit, and we're the pinch and sip folks. Well, I like what Dick Blackford calls them. He calls them the gobbling gorge brethren. That doesn't answer anything to use those terms, but they call us the pinch and sip. And so you want a large portion and spend greater time. Some of them have argued for spending like 30 to 45 minutes just on the Lord's Supper. And so you have a long period of time on the Lord's Supper so we can focus on the meaning of the Lord's Supper and talk about what Jesus means to me. And therefore we have testimonials in the midst. Now there's a great emphasis on the seating arrangement. You need to sit in a circle. That's really better, we're told. You face each other. The ridicule, the idea, and the setting arrangement like we would have here, those of you who are sitting behind someone, you're singing to the back of somebody's head, and how can that be edifying? You need to sing to their face, so we need to sit in a circle, and so that's why we need smaller. One of the reasons you need smaller groups. So we can look at one another, see each other in the eye, and that's part of the emphasis of the movement. There's a disdain for church buildings. There's a disdain for full-time and paid preachers. Go on some of the websites of these house churches and they'll say, we do not have a pastor or paid preacher. And so they don't have a regular preacher, so to speak. And there's a disdain for that, and there's a reason for that. They have a disdain for elders. Some of them in the early days, I'm not sure what they're calling them now, but 10 years ago, some of these churches were having among them what they called servant leaders. I never did know what the qualifications were or what their role was, but there were leaders among them called servant leaders, but they certainly were not elders. There is the camp, devotional, emotional, casual kind of atmosphere, come as you are. That's emphasized. Testimonials. At least 10 or 12 years ago, I got a tape from one of the services of the church that later became the church at Bowling Green, the Cabbage Church. In its inception, when they were first starting, and I don't have that, and I don't know where that thing went. But nonetheless, it was a case where there were men and women giving testimonials, basically. That you address the assembly. So it didn't matter if you was a man or a woman. You gave a testimonial. Here's what Jesus did for me this week. And here's what Jesus means to me in my life. And here's what I saw of Jesus living in me this week. And then somebody else would stand up and address the assembly, however large it may have been, and say much the same thing. There is emphasis on mutual edification over worship. That's more important than worship, it seems. Women are taking a greater role addressing the assembly, leading in prayer. There's in some of these, not all of these, some of these have hand clapping and hand waving, much like a Pentecostal kind of revival, kind of a spirited kind of movement among them. Again, the emphasis is meeting in houses and keeping the group small. There is, as Lagarde Smith suggested, no collection is to be taken. There is no need for a church treasury, only in case of need should you have that. Now, get this point if you don't get anything else. That what's going on in the house church movement is that they are against tradition. They talk about traditionalism, and what we do is traditionalism. We've had two or three songs or whatever, and then we have a prayer, and then we have the Lord's Supper, and we have preaching. This is tradition. And the goal behind that and the driving force is to be against tradition. We're dissatisfied with that. And so I raise these questions. At what point does something become a tradition? We've done it for years. But if you start having larger portions of the bread or whatever it may be or sitting in a circle and you do that for 2 weeks, is it now a tradition? Or did it become a tradition at 3 weeks or is it 4 weeks or is it after a year? When does it become a tradition? And eating larger portions, is that now a tradition? They've been doing it for a number of years, some of them for 10 years or 15. And sitting in circles, is it now a tradition? If you want to be against tradition, shouldn't we be opposing sitting in circles now after 15 years? Or after 25 years, will we oppose that? And is meeting a house now a tradition? And maybe it is because they've moved out of houses now. The house church movement is not, many of them are no longer in a house anymore. That's interesting, the progression they've made. But is that now a tradition? And how do these fix the problem of being in the rut? If we're in a rut of tradition where the focus on the Lord's Supper has lost its meaning, how does sitting in a circle now give it greater meaning? And how does eating larger portions? Could I be focusing on how good the bread is? Have me another piece of that bread. That is really tasty. And give me some more of that grape juice. It's really sweet. Now, am I focusing more on the externals? Or has it really helped me to focus on the meaning of the Lord's Supper? That's not the answer to the problems. The bottom line is being anti-tradition. So it's interesting that they have made a tradition out of being anti-traditional. That's the bottom line of what's going on. Well, when you have that attitude, then there is no limit to where things are headed. Let's move now and talk about the errors of the movement. And I'm going to quickly run through this because most of these are from things that when we see the error that's listed, we'll be familiar with what the answer is. Let's talk about their worshiping in houses. No one opposes the meeting in houses. Many churches began that way in a small way. In fact, you can trace the history of many churches that they started in someone's home. And I've been a part of those, at least not when they began, but a part of churches that started in homes and later moved out into a rented place and then later into a building. Churches met in various places in the New Testament times. For example, they met in the temple. There were thousands that met. There are at least 3,000 that we know of that obeyed the gospel. And they worshiped that same day, according to verse 42. And so they were worshiping in the temple area. That wasn't somebody's house, nor was that a small city. They worshiped by the riverside, Acts chapter 16, in the school of Tyrannus we saw in our textual study of Acts 19 this morning, in the rented hall. Well, one of the things that they argue is some of these places, like the buildings that churches may have met in, were just temporary settings. Well, 2 years is hardly temporary in Acts chapter 19. They met in an upper room in Acts chapter 20 in a government place, in a government dwelling place in Acts chapter 28, in a synagogue-type place, according to James chapter 2. The place is not specified. And so for them to tell us it has to be a house because some churches met in houses is to bind something that's not found in the New Testament. That's just not found there at all. There is no exclusive pattern of where brethren and churches met. What they see in a church building setting, an assembly, they see the function of the assembly hindered by large numbers so that it denies them the informality and spontaneity. It's kind of hard to have that informality and spontaneity here in a setting like this, but if we could get, say, 20 people into someone's home, then you have that spontaneity. And that's what they're after in some of the movement. Now, some argue from a family concept. This is a church family, and families meet in houses, and so that's where we need to be. Well, if you want to carry that kind of logic, then why aren't those disciples who are to meet in houses, if it's a family structure and a family setting and a family concept, and we ought to meet in the houses, then why don't we do like families and all dwell in that same structure on a sustained basis? Why don't we all live in the same house? Well, that won't work. They don't want to have that. It's ironic. It's what started out as a house church movement. Some of them have grown large enough that they can't meet in a house anymore. And now the church in Bowling Green, the Cabbage Church, is meeting in the Boys and Girls Club, and they're renting a place, they're renting a building. The very thing they opposed when they started. And some of the other churches are doing much the same thing. So what started out as a small church house church movement has now gone into something larger. I guess they're opposing the tradition of the past of the house movement. Here's another era of the movement, the spontaneous informal worship. We're told that the best arrangement is to sit in a circle, preferably around the table, not just sit around in a circle of chairs, but you need to sit around the table, and that's where you have table fellowship. Robert Banks argues that in page 37 of his work. Another writer said that you need to be completely, churches come together to be completely spontaneous with no one leading from the front. You don't need anyone leading you from the front. Needs to be completely spontaneous, an informal setting. Well, that's hardly the picture of 1 Corinthians chapter 14. Now, let's open our Bibles and turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 14. If you ever wonder, well, what's wrong with some of the setting of this spontaneity and sitting in these circles and one just kind of just speaks in his mind whenever he wants to, I want you to see from 1 Corinthians 14, beginning at verse 26, that there was a time and there was a place when people were to be silent. There was not, in the case of the spiritual gifts, one to be speaking and another speaking and another speaking, but if one have a tongue, let him keep silent, the text says. If one has a tongue, let it be by two, I'm reading at verse 27, at the most by three, and let one interpret. And therefore, if there's no interpreter, let him keep silent in the church. And let there be two or three prophets speak, and let the others judge. You see the idea of then verse 30, if anything is revealed to another who sits by, let him first keep silent. Here's one who had a revelation. Didn't just want to speak up and lead a prayer, but he has a revelation. He was to keep silent until his turn came. Women were to keep silent, verses 34 and 35. I'm just trying to show that there was a time when people kept silent, and that's hardly the picture of spontaneity and informality. Look at verse 40. Things are to be done decently in order. Let all things be done decently in order. Rather than the chaos like you saw at Corinth, where there was disruption in the assembly, there was not that spontaneity that Paul argued for, but there was to be decency and in order. They ridicule traditional worship as we would have. What we're doing is traditional worship, according to them, as a spectator sport. You're sitting and what you're doing is merely spectating, and you need to be participating. Well, if that was their concept, then they missed New Testament worship to start with. Were you not praying when we prayed? And were you not singing when we sang? And were you not thinking about the Lord's Supper when we observed the Lord's Supper this morning? And are you not studying and thinking and reflecting on the Word? Or is it just me up here doing that? Well, if that was their concept, they missed New Testament worship altogether. Here's another one of their errors: mutual ministry. Smith argues that houses do not have pulpits. Pulpit ministers were an invention, but mutual ministry is not. We don't need pulpits. We don't need ministers. He said elders are to be teaching pastors to the church, and the preachers should be evangelists to the lost. Now watch that carefully. You see where he's headed? What he's headed is, he's saying that each member in the circle is to have some influence and has something to say, and they have that kind of responsibility to mutual edify. Here's where he's headed with that. To this gospel doctrine distinction that has been true with a number of errors through the past. The old catcher side. Many of you have heard us talk about catcher side. We're not talking about the new catcher side of the 1960s and 70s, but the old catcher side of the 40s and 50s. Opposed located preachers on the basis of a gospel doctrine distinction. That there's a difference in the gospel and the doctrine. The gospel is to be taught to the world. The doctrine is to be taught to the church. You don't take doctrine and teach it to the world, nor do you take the gospel and preach it to the church. Smith is making that same kind of gospel doctrine distinction. And some of the writings they feed upon, John Zinn's and others, argues much the same kind of thing. Well, I want to just cite a couple of passages, and I know we're battling our time to get through with this, but 1 Corinthians chapter 3, Acts 19 and verse 10, 1 Timothy 1 and verse 3 shows where an evangelist, for example, Apollos, in Acts the 19th chapter, was an evangelist, and he was preaching to the church and dealing with the church and working with the church. So was Timothy, 1 Timothy 1 and in verse 3. And so what I learned from those passages, Paul was in Acts 10, and Paulus was here in 1 Corinthians chapter 3. I had that backwards. But nonetheless, we have evangelists that are working with the church. There was no gospel doctrine distinction, as he so argued. There is a rejection of the eldership. As taught in the New Testament, Smith argues for church-wide eldership, even multi-level elderships. There's not many, if any, of these churches that would claim to have elders within their church. I haven't found one of their websites that say, our elders are, and here they're elders. Years ago, they talked about servant leaders. I'm not sure what they're called now. But in contrast to this concept of citywide elders, elders were to be in every city, Titus 1 and verse 5. In every church, Acts 14 and verse 23. They had oversight of the church of God that was among them, 1 Peter chapter 5, verses 1 and 2. What I'm trying to suggest to you is that this concept of a citywide eldership came from Catholicism. That didn't come from the New Testament at all. I don't know where he's been reading. That is, LaGarde Smith has been reading. But he'd been reading from Tainted Wells somewhere, because he's not been reading from the New Testament. He didn't get that from the New Testament at all. That wasn't found there at all. Here's one of the errors about the church treasury. Smith argues that we need to get away from the idea of giving as mandated as an item of worship. We need to get away from the fact that's a command, and we need to do that as an act of worship. We only do that in case of need, is what he argues, when there is a need. They argue from 1 Corinthians 16, 1 and 2, that the giving is not a command, but it was only in the case of a need. Well, let's look at 1 Corinthians 16, verses 1 and 2. I want you to notice a couple of things. In 1 Corinthians 16, 1 and 2, it was a command on the first day of the week. Let me back up to verse 1. Now, concerning the collection for the saints, as I've given orders to the churches of Galatia, even so must you do. I gave orders to them. This is something you must do. It was a command of God. They argue that this is a benevolence passage, and it is true that this is a benevolence passage, but you might make note of the fact this is also a collection passage. You won't find another passage that tells you on what day to take up a contribution. You won't find another passage. You'll find passages that talk about giving, 2 Corinthians 8 and 9, but you won't find another passage that tells you on what day to take up a collection. So not only is this a benevolence passage, it is a collection passage. It tells us something about collecting, and it was given as a command indeed of God. Here's another one of the errors that we've been talking about already, the Lord's Supper. There are two ideas about the Lord's Supper. One is the Lord's Supper as a meal, larger portions, or the Lord's Supper in conjunction with a meal, with a potluck meal. By the way, one of the churches, I believe it's the church at Franklin, that lists on every Sunday on their calendar, they have a potluck meal. Every Sunday they have this potluck meal right after or right in conjunction with their worship service. The amount, this is very important. If you ever come in contact with some of these folks and they begin to tell you that you need to eat larger portions, challenge them to show you where the amount is ever mentioned in the New Testament. The amount is not suggested or hinted at in the New Testament. And I challenge any of those in the house church movement to find a passage anywhere where the Lord ever told me how much of the Lord's Supper to partake. If I take a little quarter inch square, is that too small? Then is a half inch square big enough? Or is it a 1 inch square that's big enough? Or does it need to be a 4 inch square? Or does it need to be a 6 inch square? Or does it need to be as big as the plate itself? Tell me how large it needs to be. Well, the answer is you can't find anything in the New Testament that tells you the amount to partake of either the Lord's, the bread or the fruit of the vine. The amount is not specified. Now, the only place, this is interesting, turn with me to 1 Corinthians chapter 11. The only place in the New Testament that mentions a common meal and the Lord's Supper, Paul says, don't do that. Don't do that. 1 Corinthians chapter 11, there was the abuse of the Lord's Supper and they had made a common meal out of the Lord's Supper. And he said, what, do you not have houses and to eat and to drink in, or do you despise the church of God? Verse 22. Remember that? And is any hungry? Verse 34, let him eat at home. You eat at home, but in this assembly, you need to be partaking of the Lord's Supper. The very passage, the only passage it mentions them, Paul said, don't do that. Now let's talk about the argument of the Lord's Supper and the Passover. It is argued that the Lord's Supper was instituted during a common meal. Do you think about that, that Jesus instituted the Lord's Supper? And let's stay right here in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, and we'll deal with that. The argument is the Passover meal was a common meal. And it was a meal to be consumed as a common meal, and right in the middle of that, Jesus instituted the Lord's Supper, so therefore he meant for the Lord's Supper to be eaten with a common meal. Well, I want to suggest to you that the Passover meal was not an ordinary meal. Go back and read Exodus 12. It was anything but an ordinary meal. Look at all that was involved, all that they were to have. There was the roasted lamb and the bitter herbs. It was not a common meal. It was not an ordinary meal. But you see, they take that, what they call an ordinary meal that had roasted lamb and bitter herbs, etc., and say, we can change all of that to beans and corns and chicken, etc. Now, if we can change that part of the common meal, then can we also change the elements of the Lord's Supper? Can we not change the bread and the fruit of the vine to Coke and ice cream? Why not? Why can't we do that? Oh, no, you can't change this down here because, you see, that's the Lord's Supper. Well, it was in conjunction with that common meal that you said. Why not? Why couldn't we do that? And let's notice, and you might underline in your Bible, in 1 Corinthians 11, in verse 25, the Lord's Supper wasn't instituted during a common meal or this Passover meal, but it was instituted, according to verse 25, after. You might underline the word after. And we studied in one of our classes some time ago, a workbook on the Lord's Supper. We made this point several times, and perhaps you've already got that underlined in your Bible. But in the same manner, he also took the cup after supper, the text said. It wasn't during the supper, but it was after the supper. And so they had finished the Passover meal, and after that, taking some of the elements that were involved in that, the unleavened bread and the fruit of the vine, he instituted the Lord's Supper. And by the way, the Lord didn't partake of the Lord's Supper that night. He did not observe the Lord's Supper that night. He only instituted that. He wouldn't partake of it until the kingdom was established, according to Luke chapter 22. So they missed that completely and entirely. Let's talk about the role of women. Women are addressing the assembly in some of these house churches. How so? They give testimony. Sitting around the table fellowship, they speak up in the assembly, and they're telling what Jesus means to them while they're reaching for more bread and more fruit of the vine or the chicken or the corn or whatever it may be. They're also giving open conversation during the Lord's Supper, leading in chain prayers. Women are taking an active role. You are familiar with 1 Timothy chapter 2. Women are not to have authority over man. They're not to speak or address the assembly. 1 Corinthians 14, 34 and 35. Now, here's some things that I label as new stuff. And what do I mean by that? Well, just in the last few years, there are brethren who've had to do more homework on this than I have obviously done, because I haven't had the challenge of dealing with it locally like some of them have. And when I talk to some of them, when I ask them, what is the latest? Nearly every one of these brethren will tell me that I don't know what the latest is, because it is moving and developing so fast and changing so rapidly, I don't know what the latest is. So here are some of the three things I want to mention that are some of the new stuff that's going on. Some of these, at least one or two of these, are talking about instrumental music. I haven't been able to document the use as much as some of them are talking about there's no real problem. At least they're questioning the opposition to that. Is there anything really wrong with instrumental music? Well, whether they're using it or just talking about there's nothing wrong with it, talking about there's nothing wrong with it is the step just before you start using that. And so we're just a step away from that. That's exactly what happened in the 1800s. And so already there's talk about the use of instrumental music. There is question among some in the Alabama area already questioning the essentiality of baptism, either denying it or questioning whether it is really essential or not. Well, it doesn't really make any difference. If you're questioning whether it's essential, you're a step away from denying that it's essential. And so that's how far we've gone from the idea we want to get into a church setting, home church, eating more portions of the Lord's Supper, to now using instrumental music and denying the essentiality of baptism. Some, I understand, I'm told, not that the whole church represents this, but some in one of these churches that we've just listed a moment ago are beginning to talk about latter-day revelation and claiming direct revelation from God, where they will say, God told me, God spoke to me, and God said to me. Well, that's latter-day revelation. Let's believe God's speaking directly to me. So that's why I talk about the house church movement and beyond. Now, one more thing in the lesson is yours. We won't spend much time here. I just want to suggest to you something about the evolution of the movement. What's going on now is hardly the concept that F. Legard Smith had when he wrote Radical Restoration. He had the idea of having a house church, larger portions of the Lord's Supper, setting in circles, etc. And now they have evolved into something that he would not even recognize. That's the nature of apostasy. That's how it works. Run Brother is doing some work this year on the subject of the house church movement, but he calls it the progressive movement, accurately so. It is a progressive movement. It is a very much a liberal movement that is ever evolving and ever changing. It's changing so rapidly it's hard to keep up to date. Now let's get to the heart of what the problem is. The heart of the problem is a lack of respect for authority and the silence of the Scriptures. You see, if you respect the silence of the Scriptures, like Hebrews 7:14, Moses spake nothing concerning the tribe of Judah being a priest, of which tribe Moses spake nothing concerning priesthood. That's why Jesus could not be a priest on earth, because God spake nothing about that. That tells us that the silence of God is not permissive, but it is prohibited. Now, if I respect the silence of the Scriptures, I'm going to oppose the things we've been talking about. But if we do not respect the silence of the Scriptures, then the door is open, they can't be shut. And that's exactly what F. Legard Smith did, and John Mark Hicks and others who wrote the things. They opened a door, and when they got the door open, they can't get it shut. And others are pushing things through the door that they, Legard Smith and Hicks and others, did not want. Well, now there are some people now pushing some things through those doors that they don't want. Later on down the line, there's going to be some people come along and say, well, I want to push this through that same door. You've opened the door, and you said you want to be against tradition. Well, this is against tradition. And they'll push some things through that door. And it's an endless thing. It is a progressive. It's an ever-evolving movement. Well, that's just a quick overview. That's not an exhaustive study, obviously. But that's a little about the house church movement and beyond. It started as a house church movement. I'm not sure that adequately describes it now. But we've talked about the identity of the movement, the eras of the movement, and the evolution of the movement, how it's ever-evolving and ever-changing, and it ever will. And we'll finally, at some point, not even recognize this is the movement that started from this concept of meeting in houses, because they're already getting away from that very concept. May God help us to ever be aware of the dangers of apostasy and how far they will go by going back to the authority of the Scriptures. There may be one or more present who's not a Christian, who's not a child of God. Would you come believing that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God? Would you repent of your sins, acknowledge your faith, and be buried in the waters of baptism for the remission of sins? If you're subject in any way, would you come while together we stand while we sing?